Are we on? We are on.
I guess so.
Good afternoon and welcome. Thank you for taking the time joining this session on migrating from XP to Windows 7 using Config Manager. My name is Johan. This is Michael. We will be your hosts for the next 75 minutes, and we will try to cram in as many live demos as possible throughout the session, because what can possibly go wrong in a live demo, right? So before actually starting on and do the introduction of things, I need to kick off an advertisement, because we actually will run a full refresh of an XP to Windows 7, so we will run that in the background. So I will just quickly switch over to my demo environment here, which should be number two. And before I show you that, I'm the proud father of two kids, and they are now grown older and become teenagers, and that's a challenge in its own way. But about 7 years ago, I remember very vividly the youngest one came into the office that I have, which was my bedroom at the time, and she asked, eight, if she could borrow my resource kit, my Windows Server 2003 resource kit, 7 books, 4,000 pages, and I was proud, you know, I was crying, and all right, she's only 8, but still. Turn out she found an alternate use for it. I saw that later on. Anyway, this is an XP machine I'm going to migrate, and as you can see, I have done some changes to it. There are some documents and links on the desktop. There is obviously a background image, not, you know, default XP. And if I go into the Internet Explorer in here and check in my favorites, I can see, all right, I have a TechKit Australia favorite. So I have simply done some changes to my XP. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to simply kick off an advertisement, which is optional for this machine. So let's go ahead and run this one. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. And it will eventually kick off the sequence, run the backup and things like that. So we'll keep this one running in the background. It will take about 20 minutes. And we'll come back to that later on. So, me and Michael are both Microsoft MVPs in setup and deployment, and we have been doing deployments for far too long times. I have only done it in 21 years, and Michael is older than I am, so.
Yep.
You started off before DOS, right?
Something like that.
Yeah, I begin with DOS. All right. We have a Twitter feed running in the session, of course. CLI 308, we will actually monitor that Twitter feed from up here. So if you have any questions throughout the session, feel free to tweet them, and we will try to answer as many that we possibly can in the session, and if you don't have time to answer them in the session, we will make sure to answer them after the session is completed, meaning later tonight, during the party.
And the answer, the closer midnight we come, the more interesting solutions we will have.
We can get very creative,
yes,
after a second party. All right. So the demo environment we are going to use is simply 4 servers and a bunch of clients. We have an Active Directory running all time. And we have one member server, MD201, which we will be using for light touch operations. And then we have the Config Manager server, which will be used, well, for everything related to Config Manager. So why on earth are we using light touch stuff in a Config Manager session? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, but I'm usually not allowed to answer anyway. Am I allowed to answer this time?
Yes, you are.
Okay. So the main purpose of that is to create the reference image.
It actually turns out that quite many customers are actually using LightTouch to create reference images that we then import into a config manager and deploy. And the reason are basically four things. First, it's quicker. It's about twice as fast. Secondly, LightTouch is just a folder on a server or in a workstation. It's just a folder, and you normally use an empty VM machine to create that reference image. It's very easy to hand off to someone else or to have a separate global team creating that reference image without giving them access to the config manager console. Secondly, there are things that we can do in LightTouch that is, well, not that easy to do in config manager. And that's, for example, if you want to customize the admin profile so that you later can have that being copied to default user. We can do that in LightTouch because we have an admin being logged on automatically during deployment. In config manager, that doesn't happen. The sequence is running as local system. We don't get a profile. We can't customize it.
So you mean that the old thing we did in NT4 with, you know, configuring everything and going to profile and export, we can't do that in Windows 7 anymore?
Not really, but the copy profile thing, as you know, exists. But yeah. Of course, we can, during a config manager deployment, we can go into the state restore phase, so even the post-install phase, load the registry offline, inject stuff to it, and close it. No, it's easier to do a LightTouch build for that if you need that feature. Secondly, and the fourth reason why companies do use LightTouch for this, it's very easy to suspend, to pause a LightTouch sequence if we need to do something manually. Our goal when creating reference image is, of course, to have everything as automated as we can. But sometimes, and Michael loved this, he generates his reference image every Sunday in his data center back home.
Yeah, because I can.
On a scheduled basis, fully automated. But sometimes we run into customers where you have just that application or that setting that needs to go into the reference image, and it's really difficult to automate it. So what we can do in LightTouch, we can simply add a pause to the sequence. It will abort where it's at in the sequence right now. We can do the manual change, and we can simply hit resume and continue. To do that in Config Manager, you will actually do a real build, do the change and create the capture CD and then capture it, because there is no easy way to suspend a sequence in Config Manager. So that's why we have the LightTouch server in there. And it also turns out that learning about LightTouch is a fast track to learn about Zero Touch, which we use for Config Manager, because they're using the same processes, same scripts, and it turns out it was actually the Config Manager team, their developers, who wrote the sequence we use in LightTouch. So it's the same. So, with Windows 7, we run into some immediate challenges that we did not have in the XP days. First of all, the images you will find are, you know, just that little bit slightly larger than an XP image. An XP image without the installation files is about half gig in size, Service Pack 3 fully patched, things like that. A 32-bit Windows 7 image is 2 gigs. A 64-bit image is close to 3 gigs, or 2.6 if you look at the media. Add in Office and a few updates, and they will easily go 3, 4, 5 gigs in size. So in Windows 7 deployment projects, we tend to need either, you know, really fat WAN links, or we need to move content closer to the clients. Then also we have to worry about other things related to Windows 7. If you have the nicer editions of Windows 7, meaning Enterprise or Ultimate, but you guys would probably use Enterprise, you also have BitLocker. From a deployment point of view, and now you're not really allowed to answer this one, what are the two things we need for BitLocker? Any ideas? Do you have any books left?
Yes.
Yeah, the TPM chip, that's a valid one. So, multiple partitions. One book over here and one book over there.
Is it two books, right?
Two books. Do the work. So we need the TPM chip, right? The right version, and it needs to be enabled in BIOS. And what does the TPM specification say? Well, if you don't tell the vendor you want it enabled, how will they ship the machine to you? Any idea? It will be disabled. So now we started to run into the license cost of BitLocker. And the license cost is often related to a pair of decent shoes that you hand over to the newliest hired technician in the company and tell him or her to run around to every single machine in the company, into BIOS, set a password, and enable TPM. Or could it possibly be that we can actually enable that as part of our deployment? It depends. If you're buying machines from the big guys, Dell, Lenovo, HP, they all have utilities that allow you to, as part of the sequence, configure and enable BIOS and BitLocker and TPM chip and stuff. If you're buying machines from the guy at the corner who sells them very cheap, he might not have utilities for that hardware. So it depends on hardware. Second, yes, we need multiple partitions. So if you deploy a Windows 7 DVD, put it in a machine and deploy it, it will automatically create two partitions, 100 meg and then rest Windows. If you deploy with Config Manager integrated with MDT and you want to have BitLocker, it will actually do the opposite. It will put the BitLocker partition in the end. But simple as that, if we say we want BitLocker, the solution will create the two partitions for us. We can do it manually in the sequence as well, or we can have it being enabled automatically. It's up to you guys. I will show you how to do it later. Then also in Windows 7 we have, if you look at the C drive of a newly fresh installed Windows 7, you have two folders beginning with the letter R. What are they? Recycle bin, yes, that's one. You will not get another book. The second one is? Recovery, exactly.
Yeah, I'm running.
WinRE, recovery environment, is put in that folder. So if Windows 7 fails to boot, all right, it will fail over to that one. And what we can actually do, we can take that recovery environment and move, if we want to the same partition that we have BitLocker in, or extra partition in the end. All right. Also, Windows 7 does support offline servicing. If you have an XP image and it's Patch Tuesday, how do you get the patches inside that XP image? Redo the image, build and capture, yeah. So we basically take our image, deploy to the VM, make sure it's being patched, sys prep, capture, back up again. With Windows 7, we can actually mount it on the server, inject the updates, and close it. So instead of a 30-minute operation, it's a 30-second operation. The downside is, in 07, there is no UI for this. You have to use DISM, command line utilities, or scripting to do the same thing. In 012, you can right-click the image in the UI in the console and say, schedule updates, and it will apply updates from your SUP directly on the server. So still, even though Windows 7 does support offline servicing, with Config Manager, with Light Touch, we still actually use build and capture. And speaking of that, Michael, what's the point of creating a reference image?
Besides,
there is a demo coming up.
Besides being smart, saving time, making life easier, well, there's a lot of reasons. I was number three, right? One, two, three, four. I'm number three. So, number one, how do you do this? Well, this is the way I create reference images. Number one, it's always on a virtual machine.
Always?
Always. I refuse to have the discussion. It might work on a physical machine. I don't care. Never, ever on a physical machine. Reason number one, in many cases, it will leave a footprint. That footprint will come along in the reference image for the rest of that image life, which means that you will have strange behavior in some occasions, right? Avoid that. Always do reference images in a virtual environment.
Yeah, we simply get the most hardware-independent image we can have. And we can also take advantage of snapshots, shortening the development time of that image, especially when we do testing of it.
And this is the way it should be, right? I do have a blank machine to verify that. Let me flip back to a snapshot that is totally blank. Connect, power on. And it should be booting the Light Touch Windows PE image, which looks like it's doing. Starting Windows. Looks good so far.
By the way, if you don't see these, you know, four colorful bullets flying around, and instead you will see the old Vista green bar going back and across, it turns out to be depending on screen resolution. If your display cannot do 1024 by 768, it will do the Vista style, like when you're deploying netbooks. Important information to share right there.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And as you can see, that is pretty much what I do when I create my reference images. Now it will take about...
You're actually not entirely correct. I know for a fact you have a PowerShell script that actually fires up the VM.
Yes, and kill them afterward. But you know, this is the semi-manual process. You need to power on the machine. Now, if we check behind the scenes, how is this configured? Well, I do have a deployment share in Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. You install Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, you install the Wake Toolkit, and you create a deployment share, which is a right-click deployment share. Done. That will end up in having applications, operating system, a folder structure. And the only thing we do is that we populate this with information. Things like the operating system, which is just import, straight up, nothing fancy at all. We don't need any drivers. This is a virtual machine, so we don't need drivers normally. In some cases, you actually need that if you have a virtual platform other than Hyper-V. You might need the drivers. We also need applications. And here's discussions people have. So, what do you mean applications? We use CCM. Yeah. But don't you want to have any kind of applications in your reference image? Well, yeah, but only Office.
Yeah, but the point is, in deployment projects, I fight hard to keep a thin image, because having a thin image allows me to be very flexible. I can have a single global image, and I can do different things, assign different applications depending on hardware, site, department, all those things that is good in a dynamic deployment.
Great.
But sometimes you run into a real-world scenario. I was working in Birmingham. It's middle of Alabama, nowhere, the USA. And I talked to the manager about all this, and we should have a thin image, that's the best, and we can do dynamic deployments. And he goes, yep, I like the idea. However, one of our organizations have an SLA, 1 hour. You should be able to deploy a new machine within the hour. They had about 200 applications. It's not possible to have a thin image and add post-install 200 apps. So to meet the SLA, we had to create the thick image, but we create one only for them. The rest of the company that had a thin one. So,
but there are two kinds of applications. In Light Touch, an application is supposed to be just an application, and here you can see a bunch of application samples. In this case, it's Office 2007, it's Media, it's Flash, and some of these applications you might want to have in the image, but most of these applications, most likely you're going to deploy using CCM. So maybe Office goes in. Reference images is all about saving time. If you don't need to save time, don't spend time on adding applications. But there are another type of application that we call configuration. And if I check that, you're going to see things like this. Instead of manually configuring this, we create scripts that, for instance, turn off the sidebar, disable unneeded services, modified screensavers, and a lot of things. Then we have the customer saying, well, can't we use group policy for this? Well, yes and no. About half of all my clients so far, the client team that is responsible for building the image doesn't have any form of access to Active Directory. They're not even allowed to speak with people that has Active Directory access. They can't be in the same room at the same time. There's regulations. So they are unable to use Active Directory, which I think is stupid. But I can't affect their policy, so the fact is they need to do this anyway. That is one reason. The other reason is that group policy in most cases are enforced. And that is not what they wish to have. They would like to have a preference of a value that the user are able to modify at a later time. We would like to turn off the CD-ROM autorun feature, but it is okay if the end user turn it on. And in that case, we can't really use a group policy because that's going to force that setting over and over again. We also deploy kiosk machines, workgroup machines. So this is the way to inject these settings, not manually, create script for these. And guess what? Most of the things you need and you can think of is already created by someone. It's out there on the global net called internet. So we create a task sequence. And now I can go here. Here's a reference for a Windows 7 task sequence. And it basically do all these things. And then I install my application. In this case, I want to do a defrag here. After the tattoo is done, I want to do other things like, and then I just pick all these things like Windows 7 configuration. I would like to disable the CD-ROM thingy. And then I want to add another. As for best practices, I copy the name to install application so I can see in the task sequence what it's actually doing. And I add all these things into my task sequence. Now, if I run this by creating a boot image, it's going to start asking me the name of the computer, which is totally, who cares, and language settings and all other settings. To fix that, we modify something called custom-settings.ini. And in the rules file here, I have just very simple settings. Here's a bunch of don't install the operating system, which is kind of awkward. I'm going to explain that. Admin password. Do not create the extra partition because I don't need that. Join the workgroup. Set the language, keyboard, time zone. When it's done, please shut down because you don't need to be there anymore. Do a capture, upload it to your location, whatever it is. And then we have the skip settings down here. So we're going to skip all these wizards.
Yes, do a quick change here. I just wanted to show real quick, it's currently my Windows 7 machine is now restoring user state, so it's gone through the applying OS image and a few reboots, so it's going there. Yeah. Have a few more minutes.
So here, all the skip here is about skipping the wizard pages that normally shows up. I'm doing a lot of workshops with customer, and it takes about 10 to 15 minutes to figure out how to turn these off. It's pretty fast. You open the help file and you search for skip, and there's a list of everything that should be skipped. Now, I mentioned that I did have the OS install switch set to no, which most likely means that if I try to run this, it refuses to install an operating system, and that's true. However, I do have two virtual machines with fixed MAC addresses. And I added the priority of MAC address here, and I also added my two reference machines. So if that is your MAC address, the operating system install switch sets to yes, it's going to use that task sequence, and it doesn't ask for anything at all, which means that nobody can use my lab deployment share for anything else than installing these two machines, and they will be pre-configured. Now, John mentioned one thing, and that is the pausing and suspending thing. So let's say that we, for sake of the argument here, everything works, then suddenly we need to pop in an application, and we can't figure out, not today, how to automate that. Well, we need to suspend it. Let's suspend it before we run Windows Update, so we can install the application. I steal Tattoo by doing a copy and a paste. And here it says, syscript cdi tattoo wsf, and we change that into lti suspend.vsf. That means that this sequence will now run up to this point, suspend, up to this point that says suspend. Then it will place an icon on the desktop, and you can do whatever you like with this machine. You can reboot the machine, install application, tweak, fix, do exactly whatever you want. When you're done, you're smart enough to do a save state.
Snapshot.
Do a snapshot, and then you press suspend, which will then continue doing Windows Update, install the rest of the stuff, configure the rest of the image, reboot, and upload the image. If everything was fine, everything is fine, right? If it didn't really work the way you thought, you undo your snapshot, try again, and press suspend. And we do have a bunch of customers that actually keep the machine in the suspend mode. So every time they just need to, you know, modify something, they fire up the machine, put it back in the position when it was installed, do the tweaks, press suspend, and now you don't even need to wait to a complete install.
Yeah, so we can also keep a hierarchy, you know, of all snapshots with different versions that you can quickly navigate back and through in time when you want to test things. Again, we try to shorten the development time to create this reference image. All right.
And trying to do that in Configuration Manager, well, it's kind of possible, but it just takes forever before you figure out how to do it. And we don't really like to spend time wasting time, I should say.
There was a question coming in, or rather a comment. Alan, I think, is the first name. Just a comment about we can still also use preferences within group policy to do some of the parts that Michael was showing as well. So it's a great comment. It's certainly applicable as well in addition to do scripted things like this.
Yeah, it's more of a combination, because even if you do have the preference capability, still we are in a situation that where people are not allowed to configure group policies at all.
Yeah, and we sometimes do, as you said, we deploy into work groups, and it turns out to be tricky to do group policies when we are in work groups.
Correct.
So is Alan here somewhere?
He left.
Over there.
No, he's over there.
No, they're pointing.
Yeah.
Do something.
Yeah, I'm running.
And give me back the control.
I'm not the youngest technician here, okay? I'm not supposed to be the runner.
I think you're in fact the oldest.
This is like the XP days, running around and doing it manually.
So, with Config Manager, it basically supports, you know, the most common deployment scenarios that we would like to do. Bare metal machine, of course. I started just a refresh of the machine before and replay scenarios and such. We can also do offline media, meaning once we have the Config Manager network solution up and running, we can tell it to, hey, generate an offline media for me. You can store that on an ISO file, or a DVD, or a USB stick, not drive as well. So a bare metal deployment, we simply add the Pixie media or the media to a Pixie server, press F12, and we kick off a bare metal deployment. And we can also start that from an ISO, USB, or things like that. The wipe and load that I started is basically I want to reinstall an existing machine. So I will run useMT to do the backup. I will apply my image. I will make sure all apps are installed that belongs with that machine, and then I restore the backup, all part of the sequence. Side by side is differently, because now we are replacing machines, taking the old machine, throwing out the door. So now I can't store the backup locally, because that machine is going away. So I store it on the server, I store it on the state migration point in Config Manager. So now I don't have one sequence, I have two. One to do the backup job on the old one, storing the stuff on the server. Then I go to the new machine, hit F12, and do a bare metal deployment of that one, and then make sure it's configured to restore that old machine's backup. And I will show later how that is done.
Could you give me an example of when a refresh would be the perfect solution, but you still need to do a replace?
Well, you always run into these configurations where a refresh will break miserably. For example, if you have an existing partition layout, multiple partitions and OEM partitions and stuff, and you want to reassign those partitions, you want to break them, you only want to have one. Well, you most likely cannot use the refresh. You will have to actually wipe that machine. Or you're using a third-party encryption system. Safeguard EC, endpoint protection, these things that can also break a refresh. And they need to be treated as a replace. So, how do we get this going? Well,
didn't you have a very nice blog post about multiple partitions and some girlfriends involved in that?
Yeah, I did. If I have internet connection, I think I actually can navigate that one.
Because this is a pretty common question. We have one partition for the operating system and one partition for the user's personal data. And we found a very good answer to that. So if you do have a customer that asks you about this, or if you try to do it yourself, just please remember this.
I will fix this. Give me a second. I will work this one out real quick. This is a good one.
It pretty much explains what Microsoft is going with multiple partitions for the operating system. It kind of works for a while, and then it just don't. So there's another reason to modify partitioning on drives and doing a replay.
I know it feels good inside to have multiple partitions, you know, C colon Windows, D colon data. But that combination turns out to be one of the most common issues related to deployment, just having to deal with those multiple partitions. So when Microsoft tests their tools, they normally test with one partition for the most part of the tests. So that's our recommendation, to keep a single partition if you can. All right, so here you can see my Windows 7 machine coming back. PC number 4 now deployed. So I will log in and I will allow it to initiate the desktop and the profile and things like that. UseEmpty actually have restored and create the profile for me already, but it's not initiated by this account yet. So I will simply log in and it will create that. So why do we integrate MDT Zero Touch with Config Manager? Because that we do every single time, every single project ever. I won't simply accept a project and Config Manager OSD if the customer doesn't allow me to also add MDT to it.
But that's kind of strange, because if you allow that, you will spend like 10 times the amount of time at each and every customer, and you will be very rich, because everything takes so long time to manually invent everything that is in MDT. I mean, instead of spending like 4 days at a customer, you can easily spend 6 months doing the same thing.
Well, I hate wasting time. Oh. If there are free solutions that I can download and use directly, I'd rather do that instead of spending weeks developing things that already exist. When I talk to customers about integrating MDT and Config Manager, they sometimes tell me, well, We don't want to use MDT because it will add complexity to our environment. All right? And that's the same customer, having three people working for 4 days, writing scripts that will deal with their regional settings. Because Config Manager doesn't have that by default. Well, yes, or you download a free kit and it's a one-liner in the text file. 5 minutes, 4 days, three people. Pick or choose. If you talk to a consultant billing by the hour, well, of course, don't use MDT. It will get the solution done more quickly. But for me, MDT is about three things. MDT is a development framework, making it very easy for me to quickly add changes, if needed, to Config Manager. Something that is not in the box. Secondly, there are about 100 plus additional OSD features in that package that you can start using directly. In the MDT package, you will find solutions for things you did not even know you had or needed right now, but in 2 weeks you run into this. And thirdly, well, it's free, it's supported by Microsoft, and it will help you reduce drastically the implementation of Config Manager OSD. So it's not adding a complexity, it's reducing it. And above that, give you all these nifty nice features. So to integrate this, you simply install MDT on the Config Manager site server or from any server you do the administration. That's the key part. Then you run a quick integration script that comes with MDT where you specify the site code and the site name.
This is the complex part, the integration part.
It's very complex. Yeah. And after you've done that, you will see in the console, for example, when creating a sequence, you will have additional menus that will, you know, create the Microsoft deployment task sequence. So if I run through that wizard, which is about 20 pages, I'm not kidding.
But it's very good.
It's coming. It's a Config Manager. You have to be just a little bit patient. Mm-hmm. So it's just a wizard that helps you create all the necessary steps in the sequence. So then, after doing that wizard, I won't run through all the steps, I get a sequence. And if I look in that sequence, you can see it will have slightly more steps than the average native Config Manager OSD sequence. But the point is, this is a general purpose sequence. So for example, the default sequence, will it enable BitLocker by default? If you have machine capable of it, they are TPM enabled, BIOS is password protected, will it do this, the default sequence? Will it do BitLocker? Obviously not. The enable BitLocker action is disabled. All right. If you enable this one, if you deploy it to a capable machine, will it then enable BitLocker? Yes or no? No. Why is it no? Beautiful, a book.
The last one.
Because most of these actions in this generic sequence will have conditions on them. And this BitLocker specific action say, and I hate this wording they do, but these conditions have to be true. So if BDE's install suppress not equals you, yes, is true, all right, then we will do this. So if you look in my settings package, this is how it's configured. This is where I specified that I did not want BitLocker. If I wanted BitLocker, I would flip this to yes. And now I'm using dynamics. This is not something in the sequence. I can have many sequences sharing this package, and inside this package, I can do all dynamic things I want to. I can enable BitLocker on hardware capable of it, but not to virtual machines. I can do it for accounting department, but not for marketing. I can do this for this location, but not that location. Simply by flipping a few lines of text, I can change my entire deployments. I can have different OUs depending on different type, if there's a laptop, server, desktop. All these settings that you normally would hard code in a sequence or possibly as a collection variable or even a computer resource variable. I don't have to do that. I literally don't like, I was about to say another word, but I don't like variables in Config Manager. Especially if you have a hierarchy where they actually need to flow before I can use them. By adding them here, every time I start a deployment of a client, at that point in time, it will reach the central location, get the settings, whatever they are right now, and use them. If I want this file to go ahead and query a web service, an inventory system, another database, Active Directory, I can do that. Because that entire framework lives within this text file with the MDT integration. So how difficult is it to configure this file to query a database? Oh, it's a lot of typing involved here. It is.
It's a 10-day training course.
It's a 10-day training because you need actually about 7 lines of text to have the settings package reaching out to a database to get information about your machines. So you can pre-stage all info if you want in a database and then simply use it. What about asking for a web service?
Oh, that's a 20-day training course.
Easily, right?
Mm-hmm.
It actually takes longer time to find it and to... This is it. You actually need to specify the link to the web service. And if the web service requires any parameters to it, we add them as well. What's the benefit of using a web service compared with a database? It's extremely lightweight. It's run over HTTP, so the ports are already open in firewalls. There are so little data being transferred, so you can actually, even if you are a large, and I mean large, organization, you can have a central web service storing all computer configurations for your deployments, and no matter what site you deploy clients in, they will reach to this web service, find the info, and then do the deployment from the closest DP. So we are actually reducing bandwidth here. And the beauty about web services is we can do things that we cannot possibly do in client-side scripting by running code on a web service instead. And if you don't like writing your own web services, well, steal. With pride. There are plenty of them out there. This is a Config Manager frontend. I'm using the Light Touch Wizard for Config Manager, but with web service in the back end, doing talk. In this case, accessing the database, querying Active Directory, in fact, even querying Config Manager to give me a list of sequences available for me. Even more. So this is on CodePlex. If you search for MDT on CodePlex, you will see this. Other web services, 150 plus ready-made web services that you can use right out of the box for Active Directory, for Config Manager, for the database. And how do we call them? Well, by changing a few lines in a text file. Beautiful.
Yeah, one pretty common reason to use web services is to use a staging OU.
Exactly.
You want to do a refresh of an XP machine that it belongs to organization's unit where you have a group policy that does something that breaks the sequence. So you want to move the machine from one OU to another and then move it back to the place where it belonged before. Well, try to do that using native scripting in Windows PE or something. Doesn't work. Most customers so far do it manually with a web service and with the integration of LightTouch. It's 5 or 6 lines of code or something like that, or text in an .ini file, and then you're done.
Very easy to extend anyway. So, let me flip back here for a while. Was it 4, was it? Yeah.
Yes.
So, as part of our migration, the question I would like to ask you is... No, wrong. The question I would like you to ask yourself is not whether you should use the built-in migration tools, but rather if you can afford not to use them. Because most companies, they have some setting, some data, something on the old system worth being captured to the new system. It doesn't have to be much. It could be favorites and a signature in Outlook. It could be more complex things like data locally or ODBC connections or fonts that need to be carried over. So if we don't get the stuff over from the old machine, that data may be lost. And even if that cost doesn't go from your paycheck or the end user's paycheck, it will still be a cost for the organization. But by allowing the default settings as they are, Config Manager will actually do user state migration from the old to the new machine.
I have arguments for that, because this is the usual arguments from customers. We use roaming profiles. And it's like, oh my God. And roaming profiles is going to solve that problem. And other customers say, well, we use My Document Redirections, and we don't have any settings at all. It doesn't exist any settings.
Yeah, right.
That is the most common arguments. Well, roaming profile is not going to solve the problem, because you're going to have a new profile anyway. It's going to be a V2 profile, and My Document Redirection doesn't help you at all. And you will realize that when all the users say, well, you know, this is really nice, but the address list in Outlook is gone. You know what address list I'm talking about, right? The drop-down list. Everybody thinks that is the address list. And that doesn't come over magically.
But unless we tell it to.
With USMT, it does.
All right. So what we recommend is to actually use USMT to do the migration of stuff that you need. And then, as we will talk real soon about, you configure the template to control what data is being carried over. Some customers want everything. Some customers, they want, you know, only a few things. So... All right, let's go back real quick to my demo machine here. That was yours.
Yes.
Let's try again.
That's yours.
Beautiful. This, by the way, is a known bug in Windows 7. There is a hot fix if you want this network location to go away. I'll just list this one for now. Now I have my Windows 7 box. You can see the background is carried over. The stuff I had on my desktop was carried over. And if I open IE, I have my TechEd Australia website being carried over. So it did migrate my settings, but it will keep in them locally all the time using hard links. So hard links is a feature that is basically, it doesn't matter if you have 3 gigs or 300. It will still take 3 minutes to do the backup and about 3 minutes to do the restore, because data is not moved anywhere or copied as it was in the previous version. It's just been linked. The machine is wiped, but not the linked tree. It's in a specific folder. All right. It's difficult. There's an E4 button on this one. I just have to click the right one. So... The replay scenario, as I said, is different. We need to create 2 sequences. The one that do the backup, and then we use our normal, you know, bare metal deployment. So what do we need to do in Config Manager to do the mapping between the old and new machine? How can we make sure that the new computer knows what backup to restore? Exactly. In the console, we can create mappings. We can either script this, or we can do it one by one if it's only a few machines. But I will right-click computer association, and I will do an import computer config, or computer information. And here, I simply specify, either from a text file or a single computer, I will specify the new machine name, like PC12, with this obvious MAC address of this. And I will specify a machine to actually replace. So I'll replace this one. So this is how you do the mapping. And this you do before you run the backup. Then it will assign a unique recovery key to that machine, because every backup will get its own password, and Config Manager will keep track of that. So when I hit the bare metal deployment, it now knows what backup to restore. So this is basically using the state migration point on the site server. So if you go up here and check the properties, you can see I have assigned a folder where I will store my information. The state migration point is typically one of these roles that you have on each site, because it could be a lot of backup data going back up to that share. I did a project recently. We have, on average, 7 gigs of data per client being backed up to a share. And I was lucky we had them distributed, because it would have been a nightmare if that would go up to a central share somewhere. All right. So how can we customize what is being backed up? Well, first of all, if you read the USEMT documentation, which they conveniently forgot to link to in the start menu, but it's there. If you go into Program Files and Windows Icon Docs, you will find the USEMT shump. There is the documentation. But when you read in the doc and they say migration file, they just mean the default templates. Custom templates, they are templates that you create. And config.xml file is something that works in LightTouch, but Config Manager does not support. So just skip that one for now. So this is an extremely basic template. What do you think this template will migrate? Any educated guesses? Sorry? All right, so we begin with the first line, or first section actually. There is an include section, meaning I want backup of this. It could have an exclude section, meaning I don't want backup. So include is important. But then it's the pattern in the middle that is actually controlling what is being backed up. So the first line, what will it migrate in pattern? Close. The comment was all text files in the demo one folder. Any other guesses? Exactly. A file named exactly file name text. That has to be in the demo one folder, and as the star indicates, or in any of its subfolder. If I leave that star away, or asterisk, it has to be directly in that folder to get copied. How would I change this line to do all text files? Star.txt. Yeah, exactly. So what does the second line migrate? The entire demo2 folder, right, and everything in it. Exactly. That would happen. So there are so many samples available, both default and in the documentation. So finding these guys out is a matter of hours. That's not what the problem is. The problem is when you have application A, and you call the vendor for application A, asking them for, can you please give me a USEMT template for your app? And they go, sorry? Never mind. Can you just please me what files and what registry keys your application needs, because I want to migrate the application settings? They normally don't have a clue. These are the type of phone calls that normally ends up with they asking you or wishing you having a nice day, and you wishing them something completely different back. You often have to find this yourself. So your best friend is going to be process monitor from sysinternals, the successor to file monitor regimen. So in this, and this is actually my all-time favorite demo,
And to add complexity to this is that in many cases we also go from one version of the application to another.
Exactly.
Which means that in some cases we can transfer the setting, but in that case we need to rely on the new version of the application to pick up the old settings anyway. And some applications do that and some don't.
So who is responsible for creating the template, by the way? In my opinion, or our opinion, it's the packager. I was working with a truck company. They had about 1,200 apps. How many of them required use-empty templates, do you think? About 200. So they had each packager creating small templates, sometimes just a one-liner with an ini file that was needed, sometimes longer, where there were multiple files and folders and keys that was required. And then they simply had a script that merged them together into a single larger XML file, which they then used at deployment. But it's very easy to spot an application to be a target for creating a template. Because if you deploy a new machine to a client, and someone, or you, have to go to that machine and do something, or remote into that machine and do something, well, you find your number one target to migrate settings for. Because if it doesn't matter if it only takes like 5 minutes, if you have 100 machines, it's a day. And you think they all will be the same? No. Someone will slip on the keyboard and miss three of them. By creating a template, I get it documented, I get it fully automated, and if I can do that template within a day, I go break even, time-wise. If I go it less than a day, I win. So, as an example here, as you probably might have seen, when you do settings in Notepad, like something incredibly stupid as changing the top font to Wingdings, the next time I open Notepad, do you see the... It's almost like a bunny.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah. Funny, right? Mm-hmm. Mike's blog site is deploymentbunny.com.
And there's a story behind that.
I'm not kidding.
He's a general bunny in the left.
Anyway, I closed and opened Notepad, and it's still Wingdings. So apparently, Notepad is storing settings somewhere. Problem is, I don't know where. And if I call the Notepad developer, he didn't either. Well, he probably would, but this is application A. So what I will do now is I will kick off Process Monitor from SUSE Internals. It's a free tool, and I would say one of the best tools available, because this tool allows you to specify a filter saying, I only want to monitor what this executable or this process is doing in my file system and in my registry. So I will start this monitoring. I will open Notepad. I will type 4 characters of text. I will change the font back to Times. And close Notepad, because I've learned Notepad is actually storing things when I close it. So now we can see it was about, I will stop this monitoring. It was about 5,000 events to change the font in Notepad in Windows. So now I can start peek around in here. I can start looking for Times. And we can see that, well, quite obvious, it was trying to create the Times font. Not really. That's just a call. It basically means open if it exists. So it tries to do that a few times to be sure. Then it tries to open Times Italic, also a few times here. Then it opens up Times Bold, of course. Times Bold Italic over here. And I will continue my search down. I can see it's reading registry keys. Not very interesting to me. I will continue my search. This is interesting. In the end of my trace, I can actually see that Notepad actually wrote something to the registry. It was operating regset value, meaning writing to registry. If I look in the data up here, I can see that the data that was written was actually Times New Roman. So now I can have process monitor hypnotize the registry, take me to that location, and if I wanted to migrate my notepad settings, I would simply start by migrating this key. Create a template that would migrate that key and see if that helped. So to get an example, I will go into the documentation folder I talked about. Windows Ike docs shums. Here is my use empty shum file. If I look in that shum file, in the examples here, migrating files and keys. All right. Here is a template. How difficult would it be to create a template that will migrate my notepad key? Not very difficult at all. The problem is often finding out what keys to assign. So how do we test this? How do we get efficient and trying to reduce the time developing these templates? Easy as a pie. Find the worst user you can have in the company, and you use his or her machine to do the backup of, because you always want to use the backup with live data. And backup is non-destructive. You can run the backup 1,000 times. So you will run a backup manually. You run scan state manually on that machine, pop it on a server somewhere, and then you take a VM, deploy your new corporate image to it, do a snapshot, and do a restore of the USMT manually, and see if it worked. If it didn't work, change the template, new backup, revert to VM, new restore, and go back and forth like this until you figure the template out. By using a VM like that, we can test the template like 10 times in an hour, instead of having to do full deployments just to realize, our template was broken. So take advantage of VM technology, but always use real data as the source, because you would be surprised what things you will find out there on the user machines. They can be very creative sometimes. All right. So, bare metal, integrating with MDT, dealing with user state, key for deployments. But this is often where you guys end up spending some time supporting new hardware that comes in. How many of you have more than 40 models that you support? A few of you. I would say most is probably between 20 and 30 different models. But still, it's a lot of testing, and we can deal with drivers quite differently in Config Manager. And the first thing is basically finding the drivers.
But here's another question. How many of you have been in the situation where you started on a company that has one vendor, and during the period you worked, they changed into another vendor?
Who?
Yeah. It's not that rare. It happens, right? Yeah. It's switching from, you know, Dell from Lenovo to HP for, I don't know, what reason, golfing together or, you know, other important decisions.
So the first of all, in Config Manager, we have a driver store. What's the point of having a driver catalog inside Config Manager? Well, the point is we keep the drivers outside the image so that we can inject them depending on hardware at deployment time. It's not like the old days where we're using like universal image and we had a big fat ghost image with everything in it. No, drivers are outside. And we now use different technologies to make sure right drivers is injected. But we need to find the driver. And your first bet should be go to the vendor. If you are lucky, they will have a driver. I would say Dell is currently leading because they provide now, or have been for a while, ready-made CAP files per model and per OS that you can download and import directly into Config Manager. They are not perfect, they are not, but they are closer. They are like 90%. And I'd rather start with 90% than starting from 0%. The big guys, HP and Lenovo as well, are pretty good in terms of drivers. But sometimes you run into, you have like an 8510 HP and you want to deploy Windows 7 to it, and you go to the Windows 7 driver section, there are missing stuff. What can you do then? When you can't find that, you're not allowed to answer. What if you can't find that AMT engine, that serial over LAN adapter, or PCI communication as it's being displayed in Device Manager?
Use the Vista one.
Use the Vista one, exactly. They often work, but don't use that for the video driver, though. Often a Vista driver will work because they have the same model except for video drivers. But sometimes even that won't help. Exactly, Windows Update. Or sometimes even go to the vendor of the actual device. So if your machine is an HP, but the NIC card is Intel, sometimes you will have to go to the Intel to get the correct version of the driver. Or why not, as was mentioned from over here, if I just go back to my laptop here.
But there's another thing too, because in some cases people ask me, I downloaded this, all the drivers for that model. Should we use all the drivers? Well, in some cases, you should be aware of the fact that the drivers that the vendor provides you with will also enforce you to use their own applications. For instance, in HP, they have a TPM chip driver. You don't need a TPM chip driver because Windows has a TPM chip driver. But if you do install the HP version, you also need the HP security toolkit to be able to enable BitLocker, because that driver is not a complete driver. It's just a shim driver to be able to use their application. So my principles around driver is that less is more. I only use the driver I really need, which means if everything is nice in the device manager and everything works, then I'm happy.
Exactly. So what if you have a few devices like this? I know, what's the difference between a base system device and an unknown device? Well, I know it's missing drivers. I know this in the AMT engine, but all right, this is a smart card reader, I know that. But you know, you need to figure things out. And often you can actually go to the node here, you go properties, you go details, you find out the hardware ID, and then you search for that hardware ID. Either on the internet, but also on the catalog site directly. Or you just notify the name, if you can see that. Rico, in this case, I can search for Rico drivers. Or if I want to make sure I have the latest version on my graphics adapter, I can do the same thing here. So what I can do is I can go directly to the catalog site, catalog update Microsoft.com. It installs a small ActiveX control. And now I can, for example, type in authentic to get a fingerprint driver. And it will return all the certified authentic drivers that has passed through the qualification labs at Microsoft. Or I can go to my plug and play ID or my graphics card, paste it in, clean out the revision number in the end, so I only have vendor and device, and then I search for that. And as you can see, I get a listing of quite many different versions of this specific NVIDIA driver. And sometimes when we have issues with machines, sometimes you have to try an older version. But the catalog site is a good way of finding these drivers. So first hand, go to the vendor. If that doesn't work, you know, try the real vendor of the actual device. And if that doesn't work, go to the catalog and try to find out. You can also use the good old, it's not complete, but it's good enough, PCIdatabase.com, where you can search for a vendor, you can search for a device. So I can search for 86, and no surprise, it will be Intel. But sometimes that can help you find out, all right, what is this device? And sometimes you have to install the applications, etc., to get this working as well. But that's another story. So, in Config Manager, we have two ways of dealing with drivers, or two ways of assigning them to clients. I don't like the naming, but I can't change that right now, and it's not changing in 2012 either. In fact, OSD is changing like this. in 0.12. Application model is different, but OSD is not changing. So auto-apply meaning plug and play. I call this total chaos. That's the name I have for that scenario. Apply driver package is basically saying every driver in this package, use them, no matter what. So to work with this, I normally try to stick to a few scenarios. So shorthand story is, if you are a small customer or a highly standardized customer, meaning you have very few hardware, I would say that the total chaos scenario works quite fine. Because total chaos basically uses every driver that you imported, and based on plug-and-play matching, it will try to figure out what hardware you are having. And this works great if you have maybe five models, and they're all from the same vendor. This works great, and you have one OS to deploy.
And here's the problem. This is the situation you are in today. What happens if this scenario changes over time? What is the likeliness of you going to have another operating system like Windows 8? Or suddenly you change the vendor? Well, then this method stops working. Is it easy to go from one way of dealing with drivers to another way of dealing with drivers? Well, it depends what you mean with easy. Let's try just do it once more, because that's what you need to do. You need to restage all the machine, test everything once more, and redesign the driver story. So driver management is pretty much selected once, and then you stick with it. If it's wrong, you need to redo it.
Exactly. So the default method is just import in drivers and hope for the best. And it will work for this scenario. However, what if you want more predictability? And I can't spell. Say you have maybe a few more models and multiple OSs. So say you have XP and 7 that you need to support. Well, what you can do in Config Manager, you can actually use categories to filter a driver. Because in the console, when I import my drivers, if I want to, I can tag them. So I can go to my drivers node here and just select a bunch of drivers. It's receiving information from server.
It's Config Manager.
So I can right-click and select a bunch of drivers, and I can go categorize and say, you guys belong to this category, to create a filter. And then in my sequence, when I go to my apply driver action, I can configure this to only use a specific filter of drivers. So in this case, I'm on my Windows XP, so I would probably select my XP filter. Right. Or scenario 3, which is the most commonly used in my opinion, or in my work, which is total control, where I'm basically supporting any type of organization, small, medium, large, whatever. For those, I don't import drivers at all. I just create packages. So in my workbench or in my console, instead of importing drivers, I create driver packages based on OS and based on model, like this. I simply point them to a folder structure on disk. So I have a folder structure that looks like this. And when I create my packages, I simply point it to a folder. And then it will add all in beneath.
And you said that this is the method that handles any scenario.
Yes.
Well, what is the issue if you do the total chaos and you switch from one vendor to another? Well, the issue will be the following. Suddenly, your Dell machine finds the HP driver to be a better plug-and-play match. And now we are installing HP drivers on Dell machines. And if you do have a problem with that, do you think that Dell will support that? Hey, this Dell machine doesn't work with the HP driver. Can you help me? Nope. And that is plug-and-play matching. And since you can't control plug-and-play matching, the only way to control it is to control what drivers is going to go into the Windows operating system. So Windows will pick the right one.
Right. So how do we assign these packages? Well, quite simple. I will go into the state this step. I will normally create a new node called drivers. And I will start adding in my packages by going apply driver package here. So I will go apply driver package. I will select the package, for example, my 8530 compact, give it a name, and I will assign a condition to it. Only apply this package if the following WMI query turns out to be true. Like this. And then I click OK. I do a copy and paste. I select the next package. Next name. Next filter. And off we go. Making sure that I only target specific models with specific drivers. So it's a little bit more work up front, but this really helps you to scale out in Config Manager and make sure only the correct drivers are being added.
And the beauty of this is also when we add new models.
Yeah.
I mean, new models that requires new drivers. So instead of other machines that are going to try to use the new drivers, which is not supported, and so on and so on. So you never need to restage and retest hardware.
Yep. But about the SATA driver for Windows 7, not a problem. For XP, though, if you're still deploying that and want that being injected offline, because you can still add them to the reference image if you're using LightTouch. But if you want to add them offline, you actually need to import them and create a package of them only. But then you can assign them as apply driver package. But then I normally don't use model as a filter. I use the actual plug and play ID of that device. And if you search for My IT Forum and Mass Storage XP, you will actually find a ready-made sequence that you can download, which supports about 14, 15 of the most commonly used controllers in XP. So it's a good read. So by that, we would like to say thank you for taking the time. Please remember to fill in the,
yep.
That's number four, sir.
Yeah.
Eval,
yeah.
Because you can win a touch mouse, and it's supposed to be good. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.